of civilizations and nations who is in starvation for illumination and sensation and mental lubrication. this is Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. Today's show is 197, and I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your dancing dandies doing delectable deeds while distributing delicious details and data.
I am Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris.
Recently, listener Danielle, she wrote a message to us over Facebook, and this is what she said. Of course, with these, I always ask the person, I was like, can I share this on the show?
Yeah.
And she said, yes. So Danielle writes, this is in her voice, when my husband said, I made muffins from scratch the other day, I was curious about where from scratch came from.
Because their cat is named Scratch.
Colin, do you know you're a...
I mean, you know, I've read this one before. From scratch. Sporty lingo, huh? I mean, I don't know. You say sports, like now it makes like scratching out plays in football or baseball
it's like
or something.
If you're bowling, you know, you put a line across the, you know, the scoring table. If you got zero for that round,
for
right?
the scratch, so, I mean, the score.
So I made it from nothing. Yeah. I made it from scratch. Scratches. Yeah. I don't know. Is that it?
Maybe.
no, but it stemmed from one sport and it just kind of applied to a lot of other sports. So this is what Danielle said. It is the world of boxing that has given us the concept of starting from scratch. The scratch line there specified the positions of boxers who faced each other at the beginning of a fight. Scratch later came to be used as the name for any starting point for a race or an event. The term came to be used in handicap races. For example, in cycling, those who were given no advantage had the handicap of starting from scratch, while others started ahead of the line.
Okay.
And so golf took up the term.
Scratch golfer.
Yeah, with no advantage, or basically from the bottom or from zero. And so that's where it came from. And now it's like baking. Now it's all cooking, kind of cooking related.
Yeah.
As you guys know, I was writing a shark trivia fact book, and it's about to be off to the printers.
So all
right. Exciting. Yes, congratulations.
It is. Yeah, I know so much about sharks.
More than you thought you would ever know about sharks.
I made sure all your Good Job Brain favorite things we like to talk about is in the book, too.
You're at the top of the amateur shark game, basically.
Yes, right? I am. I'm not pro yet.
You're not pro. Well, you're not like a shark doctor.
What's a shark expert called?
That is in the book. It is called a shark biologist. Or like a marine biologist.
Right. So basically, for someone who's not a marine biologist, you're pretty up on your sharks.
Yes, yeah. Okay. I know. It's not very exciting.
I thought it was an ichthyologist.
Yeah. I thought it was like aggresso ichthyologist. That was one of the bogus answers I threw in. You know, and there's some like
shark theology.
And you're like shark theology. Right. I said sharkist.
Sharkist.
Yeah. It's just marine biologist.
I like how you had like the scientific ones and the answers shark expert.
Yeah. Well, that's the hard part of writing this book is like, you know, I have to ask a good question, like a good fact, but then I also have to provide two additional...
Writing multiple choice is hard.
You know, and I want to make it fun, so it's not you're just like, ah, so what? You know, is it one, three, or seven? You're like, I don't care. You have to kind of make it funny, and a lot of the effort was kind of bad answers.
Like 10% facts and 90% thinking of jokes.
Yeah, pretty much a lot of puns.
Yeah,
that's good.
Did you get William puns. Shakespeare in there?
Gilliam.
Oh,
Gilliam Shakespeare.
Two levels.
Wait,
but there is a Shakespeare.
Is there
pun.
Still time?
There is a Shakespeare pun.
Oh, okay.
Nice.
Yeah. No, oh, I'm not gonna spoil.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's for the price of $15.
You gotta buy the book to find out what the hidden shark pun is.
Right? Yeah. So it's available on pre-order on Amazon.
Okay.
It's my shark book, and also we have our own Good Job Brain book.
Yeah,
That is also available in fine bookstores and bookstores online near you.
Yeah.
All right. Without further ado, let's jump into our first general trivia segment, Pop Quiz Hotshot. Ooh, my voice went a little harder.
We got new batteries in our fresh, barnyard buzzers. So
fresh bats for our buzzes.
Strong. crowd.
Yeah, this horse sounds. Hasn't been this loud in a while.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Here, I have a random assortment of Trivia Pursuit cards from different versions of the game. And half of these are old silver screen, so get ready. All right, oh. Colin, left hand, right hand.
Right hand.
Dana, left hand, right hand.
Left hand.
Chris, left hand, right hand.
Left hand.
Trivia Pursuit 90s.
Yeah. Yes. Man. Right. 90s. Just
how is
90s.
It possible that we have so many of these cards. 1995. Are you
it's,
kidding?
I think we have a 95 we edition. Must have had it's this always card. 95. Yeah. Like, it's never 93 or 97. It's always 95.
Okay. See, I'm reading this card and it seems familiar, but then some of the questions I don't remember. I feel right. like I should remember. So I'm going to ask.
Forge ahead.
We again, this mystery box might have repeats. Here all we right. go. This one's a little bit blue.
Really?
Most of these questions are a little.
Well, weird. I don't remember that.
Ah, okay. I thought the stand was family friendly.
All right. Pink Wedge, 1995 Trivia Pursuit. Buzzers ready. Pink Wedge, what movie about the spread of a deadly virus hit theaters in 1995? Killing plans for a movie based on The Hot Zone. Colin.
Was that Outbreak?
It is Outbreak.
The Outbreak Monkey.
Yes. Yes.
Yep. Killing plans for a movie based on The Hot Zone. Is that a book?
Yeah. Is it in italics?
Yes.
Yeah, it must have been a book about.
Oh, good,
yeah.
good sleuth. What 74-year-old cooking icon took her red spoon online to make every day homemade? Dana.
Betty Crocker?
Correct. It is Betty Crocker.
Okay.
Who is
not a real,
not
person.
Not a real person. That's why I was like, yeah, but Red
just
Spoon
a,
is right.
It's just
yeah.
a brand. Yeah,
she is
Red
74,
Spoon.
Yeah. And a cooking icon. Mm. So she was a real person. Yeah. All right. Okay. Brown Wedge. Who appeared in epic films, Live Nude Girls, and Porky's before Sex and the City beckoned?
And, oh.
Dana.
Kim Cattrall?
Correct.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Samantha.
Yeah. And Mannequin,
such a,
too,
she's
right?
a mannequin.
The lead, the title the role.
Titular role. Yeah. Orange Wedge, what retired newscaster topped all 1995 media poll categories except most attractive?
Oh, no.
Wait, what retired?
Newscaster topped all 1995 media poll categories except for most aww. Attractive.
So if it's retired, it could insult. Be anybody, right?
So retired at 1995.
Oh, retired that year.
I think so.
Oh.
Walter Cronkite?
Correct!
Oh, I was going to guess that, but I thought that was way too late.
He has a sexy grandpa thing.
I guess
going.
I guess he was still yeah. active into the 90s. Yeah, like, I don't know why I thought that was earlier.
Like a professor.
Yeah, oh no, I can see that.
Green Wedge, who did South Africa pick to head up the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that investigated apartheid atrocities? That was the horse, which is Colin.
Nelson Mandela?
Incorrect.
Who did South Africa pick, and it wasn't Nelson Mandela?
Don't know.
It is Desmond Tutu.
Yes, Bishop Desmond Tutu.
Bishop.
Yeah, it's like, think of the second South African man.
Yeah.
And it's like,
right.
Yeah, it should have been like Desmond Tutu.
Nothing. It's not Nelson Mandela.
He was in the punch bowl, but it couldn't.
Okay. Desmond Tutu. Yeah.
Fish it out.
Yeah.
Last question, Blue Wedge. What 54-year-old singer took everything off but her boots for a Playboy cover? In 1995.
54-year-old singer, 1995.
Oh.
Colin.
54-year-old singer, 95. Tina Turner.
Incorrect. Dana.
Nancy Sinatra.
Nancy Sinatra.
These boots are made for walking naked through town. Yeah.
I guess that worked. The ages. Yeah, okay. All right. Yeah.
In 1995, she was 54 then.
Yeah, I guess, I was thinking she would have been older, but no.
Good work, you
all
guys.
Right.
And that one's going to go into the trash, so we'll never see it again.
That was kind of blue.
Yeah,
there was a little bit.
Yeah, Playboy. Yeah.
But do you want that or Baby Boomer?
No.
As long as it's real Trivial Pursuit, I will take any card.
Oh my God, you're kidding me. I'm sorry. I got to share.
What is it?
What's that one?
This is from Baby Boomer. Mm-hmm.
Give me the Baby Boomer card.
Yeah, I will take that card every day.
Colin is not a Baby Boomer.
What color was C-3PO?
C-3PO is gold.
Say, yeah. Is it goldenrod?
Who shot Spider Savage?
What?
Sabich? Spider Sabich?
What's the category?
I don't know.
An N?
NN.
National News?
Not news.
Who shot
I mean, I need
spider?
To know if this is a real person or...
It sounds fake.
Spider, it does
Although
sound
the last
fake.
Name.
Spider, S-A-B-I-C-H.
Wow. It's not a ringing a bell.
Nope.
Nope. Spider Jerusalem is a comic character.
What's okay. the answer?
Claudine Longet.
Oh,
Longet.
Sure.
Oh.
Sure. No.
That's, it's ringing a bell, but no. Yeah, it's the answer is, yeah, the answer's ringing a bell. I don't know why.
What else is on there? What else is on there?
Whose buckaroos were the buckaroos?
Whose buckaroos were the buckaroos?
Were the buckaroos.
What's Roy the Rogers's? Category?
RPM. Oh, okay.
I mean, category matters. Yeah.
RPM.
Yeah, RPM.
So records?
Oh, records probably. Yeah, okay. So that's not a bad guess.
Roy
yeah.
Rogers?
Yeah, Roy nope. Rogers. Yeah. Buckaroos.
Buckaroos.
That's got to be Gene Autry.
Nope.
I mean.
Who is
it? It is.
Howdy Doody.
Buck what? Owens.
Oh, Buck oh, Owens. Okay. Geez. All right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I've comedy writer. And okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Buck Owens. Yeah. Famous.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Another Playboy one. What first did Mary and Madeline Collinson achieve in the October 1970 issue of Playboy?
1970.
Sisters? Well, was it the first twins in the centerfold?
Yes, yeah. First
twins. Oh, I thought it was Mary Ann. Just not Mary Ann. Oh.
first twin playmates.
Oh,
first okay.
All right.
A lot of Playboy questions in Trivial Pursuit.
Well, I mean, these are random,
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
You know, last one. Who said, I've kept my identity separate from Edith's? If I keep on in the role, people will never think of me as anyone else. Good luck.
Edith.
Oh.
I don't even know what...
I've kept my identity separate from Edith. If I continue on in the role...
What's the category?
Probably TV.
TV.
Okay. Well, it could be Broadway or TV.
Edith.
No, I'm guessing it's Edith Bunker, but Edith. What's the name of the actress? Was it
Stapleton?
Oh, my God!
Yeah.
James
yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Not,
yeah, that's yeah, yeah, and this okay, is where yeah. category yeah. matters. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Not bad.
Yeah.
All right. Good job, brains.
Colin, you know the trivia of what was the first item ever sold on eBay, right?
I do. We talked about this. Yes, yeah. It was a broken laser pointer.
Yep. Purchased by... a collector of broken laser
pointers,
thus proving in one shot the magic of eBay that there is a buyer out there
for everything.
Wait, so but is that the real story? Because like
that is
some,
the real
some
story.
Of the startups they have like a kind of marketing.
eBay's fake story is that is that the wife of Pierre Omidyar was a Pez collector.
And Pez dispensers.
Trade,
yeah.
She wanted to trade Pez dispensers, but really they had formulated eBay from a very kind of abstract idea of like this will be the perfect marketplace.
But no, that's the beauty is you're right. There is, you don't need to worry. Your audience will find you. Like for every deal, there is someone willing to make that deal.
That's right. And these days with eBay and Craigslist and, you know, we have all of these different ways for everybody to get involved in buying and selling and wheeling and dealing.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We see that a lot more
Clothes.
These days.
It's all like automated and easy.
So that got us thinking about buying and negotiating and haggling and making the best of a situation.
So this week, let's make a deal.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
So yeah, let's kick it off by talking about negotiation. Let's talk about bargaining, haggling. I'm a yard sale guy.
Yeah,
since
you
I was
are.
A kid.
Yeah,
you are yard an expert in the craft.
Exactly,
in the craft.
I mean, in going places where prices are where it's assumed that you're going to be negotiating prices.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to yard sales and flea markets, that's just all part of the game. The
price you are. I've witnessed you at work, and you are an unabashed like just slash and burn haggler. You know, person gives a price, and Chris is like, I'll give you 20% of that.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's very important to do stuff like that. I mean, the thing is, you know, what I kind of realized in life is people have a lot of internal rules for is it okay to haggle or not? And the only rule is this: if the person that you are talking to has the authority to change the price, you can haggle. So, I mean, certainly at flea markets and yard sales, if you're talking to
it's
the person
stuff.
Whose stuff it is, you can haggle. Of course you can haggle. They might not be receptive to it, but you can try and you can try different things. If you're at a store and it's a small mom and pop shop, You can haggle if you're talking to the owner or the manager or the person who has been who has authority vested in them. You can't go to Walmart and haggle with the person at the register. It doesn't work. But there are people who will tell you that they would go to like a Target and find something that's open box or damaged that's not been reduced in price and find a manager who actually does have the authority in ad hoc situations to give a manager's discount on something that's busted.
And get it off the floor.
And get rid of it. And again, if it's an independently owned store, I mean, you got to kind of suss out, like, who am I talking to here? Is this a person that I can negotiate with? So there are psychological things at play here. And people have done a lot of research on this. And so there's a lot of fascinating stuff about pricing. You're the seller and you're putting a price on something, you know, pricing trickery, you know, everything from this is available in just 4 easy payments of $19.99, you know, something like that.
$19.99 versus $20.
Which we've talked about on the show before. When we talk about pricing, that comes from what is called left digit bias, which is we read from left to right. And so if the first thing we encounter is a one, then we're already thinking, oh, this is $10. It's $10 and something. So if it's $19.99, it's actually $20. But you are really, and again, they've proven this, you are really thinking it's in the $10 area. So one of the major things that I want to talk about is the idea of the price anchor or anchoring. And this says, I mean, first of all, basically this says is the first number that gets thrown out, that is what gets held in everybody's heads as like, it's like throwing the anchor off the ship. The ship can move around, but it's anchored mostly to that point. And so it kind of sticks you there. This doesn't mean you go to a car dealership and say, I'll give you $10 for that car. and they're going to say, take it 30. That's not going to happen. But it does, if it's not an extreme situation, if you are sort of in the ballpark, then that price anchoring does work. It is an advantage if you are negotiating to be the first person to throw out a price. Yeah, because that anchors the discussion nearer to your price.
So for example, you're at the flea market.
Yeah.
It has a sticker on it that says $50 or something.
Well, so now the don't price has say, been anchored at 50.
Well, what if you don't say 50? You're like, I'll give you 20. So you're like trying to anchor it
lower.
Yeah. Yeah, if it's stickered, then you can go up and say, hey, I'll give you $20. But then you know what the seller really wants is 50. So you do actually risk offending them at that point, making them not want to work with you, thinking that you're like lowballing them. Okay. So it has to be at that point. See, but then again, for you mentally, like the price is already, it's already 50. So you're offering 20, which is where if it wasn't stickered, you might offer 5.
That's some mind-twisting stuff.
Okay, well, here's what's really going to mess with you is that the studies that they've done, you can get anchored to a number that isn't even the price of the item. It can just be a random number. So they did, you know, and now start looking for this in real life. They might say, this item is $39.99 and 50,000 people have taken us up on this deal so far. So you might see 50,000, even though it has nothing to do with the price. And now your brain is thinking about the number 50,000.
Stupid brain.
And therefore, $49.99 sounds really low. They did a study with college students and expensive bottles of wine, figuring the college students wouldn't know what expensive bottles of wine cost. And they were like, okay, first, recite your social security number. I don't want you guys to do this.
Okay.
But they said, first recite your social security number. And then they showed them the wine and they said, how much do you think this wine costs? The students whose social security numbers ended in a pair of higher digits guessed that the wine cost, it was literally like, would guess that the wine cost like $25, $30.
Oh my God.
And the students, if their social security number ended in lower digits, they would guess that the wine cost like $8, $10.
Because they primed themselves.
They played themselves.
Say it again.
They would recite their social security number, and if their social security number ended in higher digits,
so say like 89.
Yeah, they would guess that the wine was more expensive because they're thinking about their anchored to high numbers.
Wow! Yeah. So they might think, say, $99,
yep.
And someone whose social security ends with
0 or 12
would be like, oh, it's going to be like
$8.
Wow. If you're going to buy something and have like four models, right? And like the cheapest model is like, this is $8.99. Mm-hmm. They don't really, they know that no one's going to buy the cheap model, but they're just setting the anchor of the price, right? Just to sort of prime you.
That's why
this is the.
On a wine list at a restaurant, they'll put the really, really expensive wines up at the top. So you can get $1,000 for a bottle of Dom Perignon. And you see that and you're like, well, I'm not going to spend that.
Okay.
And then you go down the list and it's like, well, how about you spend $300 on this bottle? And you're like, okay, well, that's a good deal.
Okay.
And if they do it the other way, you would start with the cheapest wines and then you'd see, you'd be like, oh, okay, well, I'll get a wine for $8. Mm. Then you look down at the bottom like, $1,000, that's ridiculous. I get this one.
The order matters. The order matters.
Yeah, order absolutely matters. Yep. They don't put dollar signs front of a lot of these things. They don't want you to think, if you take the dollar sign away, it's not money anymore. Like, that's a big thing. And these are all, there's so many things. Here's something that really totally blew my mind. This is from this abstract of a study. Consumers non-consciously perceive that there is a positive relationship between syllabic length and numerical magnitude.
I believe it means
that if I tell you that the price of something is $17.73 versus if I tell you that it's 1801, you would perceive 1801 as being a cheaper price.
Yeah.
So the more syllables that are in the numbers when you say it out loud, people absolutely, according to this study, perceive that as being more expensive.
I can believe that. And I hate my brain for that seeming logical, but I can believe that.
Yep. Okay, so what are some negotiation techniques? Let's get down to the nitty-gritty. I would never go up to somebody and say, I see this a lot, and it's kind of sad. But it's just like, would you possibly be willing to go $4 on this? It's much better to state it as a fact, like, I can do $4, you know? And then to really create in the seller's mind a sense of urgency, oh, it's not $4 or he's going to pay me all the money. It's, this is the deal. And I'm going to walk away if you don't agree to this deal. I mean, you have to be able to walk away. And even if you're not willing to walk away, you need to actually make it seem as if you're going to walk away. And my out, by the way, if they were to say no, is to say, yeah, okay. I mean, I guess I'll do $5. You know what I mean? Like that kind of a thing. Like I'm reconsidering what it was, even though I was totally going to pay $5. Also, definitely don't negotiate if the price is already way too cheap. Because that could backfire on you.
Right.
What do you mean backfire?
Don't call attention to it.
If the price is a huge super steal, just pay him the money and get out. Don't try to negotiate it down. Because then what could happen is they might say, well, let me look it up to see what it goes for. You don't want to prolong the situation. This I see all the time, and this is really true. The idea of cash in the face. You know, if something is $40 and you say, will you take 20? Don't just say, will you take 20? Literally get the $20 bill out and have it showing. And
will you take this?
It to them and be like, will you take 20?
You should do this.
You should.
Yeah.
Because at that point, you've created a situation where they're literally looking at the money.
They're turning down money at that point.
That's right. No. It's not abstract. It's actual money that's sitting right there.
Do you want this money in your hands?
Again, so on the other side of this, if you're going to have a yard sale, if you're going to sell stuff, you know, this is the stuff to watch out for, that you are, you know, make sure you're making the right decision and you're not sort of like falling for these.
And be ready for it. The worst haggling experience I ever had, I was in a vintage shop in Portland, Oregon with my wife when we were traveling. And they, for whatever reason, were having like a blowout of this like antiques and curios and random junk stuff. And it was like, everything must go. So I found this cool old timey, you know, it looked like it was from like maybe in the 20s, like a segmented folding dressmaker's ruler. And I'm like, oh, hey, this is really cool. How much is this? How much do you want for this? Mm-hmm. And the guy's like, make me an offer.
Oh, geez.
So I'm like, $1.
Yeah.
And the guy makes the most disgusted face and he's like, fine. And I'm like, well, excuse me. I'm like, yeah, excuse me for insulting you. I'm like, here's your dollar. I'll take the ruler and leave. Yeah.
Well, this is precisely the reason why when somebody says to you, you make me an offer. That's just putting you right in the driver's seat, and you did the right thing. Because what happens? Yeah. What happens? Well, what happens is if the seller is, I mean, honestly, as the seller, you really have a responsibility to like tell people what the price of something is. Because like, I'll buy anything at the right price. It's like, well, do you want it or not? It's like, no. If I go into Target and everything was 50 cents in Target, I'd buy all of it, right? Like, wouldn't you? Whether or not I want to buy something is not just about the thing. It's about the thing and also how much does it cost? Price elasticity of demand and on a microeconomic level, being the micro being me, right? Yeah, yeah. As a seller, you have to tell me how much it is because I don't know if I want it unless you tell me how much it is. So that was precisely the way to play it, Colin.
Okay, I mean, all right.
Yeah, exactly. And again,
he did a bad job. Not you.
And if yeah. you as a seller don't want to sell have to deal stuff. With that, like, yeah. you have to set the price. As the seller, it is to your advantage to set the prices on things.
Yeah, I don't know why I walked out of there feeling guilty and ashamed, you know? I mean, I had a cool ruler, granted, but... Right.
I have heard this story multiple times where somebody goes to a yard sale... They see a rare video game because that's what I buy. But they see a rare video game and it's like $200. And they're like, this is it. This is what I go yard sailing for. You know, I get up early in the morning and like I finally got the big score. And they're like, oh, it's marked $3. Well, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be the nice guy and I'm going to say to the person, hey, this is worth more than $3. So I'm going to give you $20 for it.
No.
And I heard this story, and what often happens is the person says, what do you mean it's worth more than $3?
No.
And then they look it up, and then they're like, I'll take $200 and not a penny less.
Yeah.
And then you've completely ruined the whole thing. It's not even really being a nice guy, because you're still, like, you're still paying way less, you know?
I'm going to rub it in your face a little bit.
It's
it's
sort of like a psychological way to... assuage your own guilt. You know what I mean?
Do it after it's your own property.
And, you know, one of the really important things is that negotiation begins before you even know if there's anything that you want to buy. I mean, especially if you're walking up to a yard sale. Like, and this is an easy tip to give because it's just be a nice person. Do what you should do as a nice person, which is when you walk into somebody's driveway, look at them and say, hello, how's it going? You might be already doing this. Well, if you're already doing this, that's great. You're very nice. And also, it's an excellent negotiation tactic because if you skulk up into somebody's property and you ignore them and you don't look at them and you don't say hi and you don't make any gestures toward them, and the first interaction you want to have with them is to walk up to them and say, like, hey, we take $5 for this, like, you're going to be in a much worse situation than the person who showed up and was nice and said hello, because that's the beginning of the greasing of the wheels that of the economy.
Yeah, it's like a machine.
You're also paying them by letting them help you, because people get high off of that too. You're like, hello, I'm a nice person, you want to be a nice person to me? That's the Dana manipulation. Like my negotiating technique.
Yeah.
The sweet poison.
And also, you'll never get anything unless you ask. If you go to a flea market and you see something sitting there and it's marked $50 and you think, oh, that's cool, but I would only buy it for $20. I mean, really, you have to know like what your top dollar is, and then you can say to that person, hey, would you take $20? And they might say yes.
Yeah.
They might say no, but they might say no only because they think that you're going to start raising your offer higher. If you want it, just throw out a price, and then they might say no, and then you say, okay, and you put it down, and you walk away, and like... Sometimes before you get two steps away, they will be like, oh, okay, no, and you'll call their bluff and they'll take it.
Does it work if you're like, oh, I only have $20?
No, never do that.
Don't do that.
If it's true, oh wait, are you talking about lying or telling the truth?
Telling the truth. Like you said, I can give you $20 for this, I like it, and they're like, no, and you're like, I only have $20.
Yeah, sometimes that can work. If you literally take out your whole entire wallet and you open it up, like, and there's only $20 and you're just like and you're like, I'm actually serious. I don't have any more money. Like, this is all I have.
Yeah.
That can actually, then they know you're not bluffing, but definitely don't do that if you actually have more money. Well, there is Chris's negotiation.
Oh,
I like
it. Oh, 101.
We should go on a field trip to the flea market. Oh, I want to try it out.
See it in action.
Yeah.
See it out in the wild. All right, my turn. Because you suggested the title of the topic,
which
is Let's Make a Deal.
Yes.
First thing I thought of was game shows.
Of course.
Game shows. Yeah. A famous game show.
But not Let's Make a Deal.
They revive Let's Make a Deal.
Yeah. Wayne Brady. Yeah.
I felt inspired, and so I have some questions and facts about game shows.
All right.
And I apologize to our non-U.S. listeners, our international listeners, because this is kind of U.S.-centric, but some of these shows have versions. Multiple, like, different versions in different countries.
I've been surprised, traveling internationally, what game shows have popped up, you know? Yeah. Like, either in a localized version or just imported straight from America.
And surprisingly, a lot of the reality and game shows we get here are all based on another international.
I'm not gonna say too much. This might be in your quiz. Like all the Endemol shows, right?
Weakest Link was British. Mm-hmm. Shark Tank, even though that's not a game show, it's a reality show.
It's sort of it's a speculative reality show.
Right.
And let's write down our answers. Listeners, if you're
here, go.
If you're
thank you.
Driving or on commute, shout out your answer. freak other people out.
You roll down the window, just shout it.
Call 911.
Passersby.
Call 911, yell out the answer.
No, don't do that. Don't
you pressed your luck. I don't know. The lady, she was just shouting, press your luck, and she drove by. I don't know.
Going to a bank. Who wants to be a millionaire? So you guys got your pens and paper ready. Here we go. Speaking of international versions, what show was originally created in the Netherlands called, translated, Hunt of Millions?
Hunt of Millions?
Yeah. And it is not an obvious answer.
Oh.
Hmm.
The word million is not
in the American
in the title of the American. Hunt of Millions. Hunt.
Okay.
All right. Locked in?
No.
I'm not. It's ridiculous.
Answer.
It's the worst question.
It's probably describing the game mechanic. Hunt.
Okay. I'm a game designer.
I show up.
It is a clue.
I don't know. I'm so inside my own head. I don't know.
Okay. All right. Answer's up. Colin, you say.
Weakest Link.
Dana.
Deal or No Deal.
Wheel of Fortune.
It is Deal or No Deal. Because you're hunting for the millions.
That's the one with the suitcases, right?
The briefcases.
Or briefcases.
Follow-up question.
That was a real big thing for a couple of years.
Yeah, it was.
Follow-up question. How many briefcases are featured in Deal or No Deal? And there's 20-something.
Yeah, you almost said the answer.
Narrows it down.
Funny. Answer's up. All right. 20-something was your clue.
I said 27.
28.
26.
26!
Oh, yes. Dana's killing it.
And it was really big. And actually spurred a lot of mathematicians and statisticians and probability experts in kind of figuring out what their algorithm was.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Next question. In some of these, I will actually ask an example question from the game show.
Oh.
Ooh, so it's double part. So here's one from a favorite, Price is Right.
Yes.
Daytime favorite.
I love The Price is Right.
Price is Right is a show about pricing, knowing the prices of random things and estimating.
Mostly things you would find at the supermarket.
Yes.
In general.
Yeah, yep. Or grocery stores.
Lots of pool tables.
It's not 100%.
Cars,
it's not 100%.
Sets,
it's not 100%.
Entertainment centers.
Yeah, very homey stuff.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of mini games you can play. So why don't you guys tell me what you think the price of a Tide bucket of Tide Pods Turbo Laundry Detergent packs for 81 load tub.
So 81 pods.
So it's 80. It says 81 load. So
You can't do a half a pod.
That's true.
Oh, challenge accepted, Chris.
Tide Pods are those candy colored
so detergents.
They look so Willy Wonka. Tide Pods, Spring Meadow scent.
Okay.
To be specific, Turbo Laundry Detergent pack. 81 load tub. What is the price of that? And just so everybody knows, I got this from Amazon.
Okay.
So it might be a lower. Okay.
Okay. So, Colin.
I said $14.99.
$14.
$17.99.
Correct answer is $18.97.
Oh. Welcome to the Showcase Showdown.
Fun fact, on Price is Right, we see a lot of cars. Right? Yeah. You can win a brand new car.
Yeah. Cars, a brand new car!
Cars get shown more often during the show than other prizes because the show gets paid a flat fee every time the car appears.
Right. It's an ad. It's like an ad for the car.
So it's like, you win a Chevy
And they list all the features. Features air conditioning and DVD entertainment. Cool. Yeah, right.
Air conditioning.
Fancy.
Mr. Fancy.
A millionaire's car. Next you're going to tell me it's got windows.
I read something about The Price is Right recently. It was that you have to pay taxes on your prize.
Yeah, you do. Everything.
So sometimes people were turning down prizes because they don't want to pay the taxes on it.
That's right.
I've also heard that most people, by and large, will take the cash equivalent for like these large value prizes. It's a brand new car or a check for whatever.
Or it's like you're going on vacation.
Right.
Or we'll just give you the money. Because then they take it and they pay the taxes out of it and they get the rest. Yeah.
Do you need this boat?
Right. I live in an apartment. Where am I going to put a boat?
I read that there are also people outside the studio of taping and offering
Really? Stuff off of you. Like if you win something, I'll buy it from you?
Yeah.
It's like reverse scalpers. It's just like a dude pulling a boat home at the end of the day, just up a hill.
All right. Next game show related question. What game show features the song called Time for Tony?
Time for Tony?
Time for Tony. Tony who?
Yeah, interesting.
Time for Tony. All right, answers up. Colin.
I feel good about my guess, which is Jeopardy.
I put Jeopardy as well.
What is Jeopardy?
Correct, it is Jeopardy. Yeah. Now it's rebranded as The Think! Exclamation point. That's the title of the song.
Oh, yeah, if you want to buy like the 12-inch remix of it or something. Think. Yeah,
the club remix.
Yeah. But the 24-minute version.
We all know it was written by Merv Griffin. He wrote it as a lullaby for his son.
Really?
I think I've heard that.
Yeah. So you can see in your head it's very lullaby-ish.
It lightly infringes on I'm a Little Teapot. You know, just a little bit. Pour me out. Yeah.
Griffin estimated that royalties from the theme song earned him about... $70 million.
Yeah, I bet.
Royalties from a song he wrote for his own show. He's the king.
He did a good job.
He's the king.
Yeah. And speaking of which, I have a final Jeopardy question. This was from a few months ago.
All right.
Hopefully you guys didn't watch that episode.
No.
So here's a final Jeopardy question.
All right.
Created in 1971. This company's logo has been likened to a wing and was supposed to connote motion. And pour me out.
Boom, boom. Little kettle drum there at the end.
I don't.
Colin, you say.
I believe it's Nike.
Dana.
I put Alair.
Chris. What is
Nike?
It is Nike. Yes, the wings of Nike, the goddess of victory.
Yes, as my art history professor would pronounce it,
Nike. Milwaukee. Conquering for the good land. All right, next game show. We're moving on to the Wheel of Fortune. Mm. Wheel of Fortune. Old style Wheel of Fortune. It's a letter. Each letter has a tile, and Vanna White has to flip.
Yeah.
Right now it's all touchscreen.
Right.
So how many touchscreen monitors are there on a Wheel of Fortune board?
Geez. Oh, interesting.
If you can think about how many lines estimate.
Is it two or three rows? Dana, tell me.
I can tell you the answer to that.
How many monitors are there? So if you fill it up all with letters.
I'm trying to count the letters.
Just give me an estimate. Chris is locked in.
I'm locked in.
They're counting.
I'm not confident, but I'm locked in.
36.
We have to write down your letter.
Oh, we're writing down.
I thought we were in the what's your answer stage. I'm going to write down a different number.
Mess with us.
Yeah,
that's your anchor. That's your anchor.
I wrote down 36.
I wrote down 36.
This is 60.
The answer is 52. Chris wins again for closing.
He went over.
This is a wheel of fortune.
Okay.
So in case of anybody, it's four rows.
Yeah, that's four rows.
I thought it was four.
First row is 12, 14, 14, 12.
It's not even symmetrical. Or I guess it's symmetrical, but it's not balanced.
I was calculating it based on four rows of 15 each.
Oh, so close. You're close. All right, next game show. What game show lets losing contestants keep their jaunty colored sweaters? Wait. So they might not win a prize, but losers will take home what they're wearing to the on the show.
A jaunty
like a
This isn't right, but this is they definitely have uniforms they wear.
I'm writing down. Think of a show and they wear uniforms.
Huh.
Or you know, team
color things.
It's a sweater for sure.
That's a sweater.
This is a Karen Chu childhood favorite game show.
Maybe I got it right. We'll see.
That helps.
Not
me.
For kids.
Oh. Right?
Oh, really?
Right. Not for kids.
Oh.
I think
because I know everybody's like, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? It's not.
Everybody had a. Okay, hold on.
You said not for kids.
Not for kids. I've never heard of that, so I'd never write that down anyway. It's not for kids. It was a Karen Chu favorite. And they wore colorful
sweaters.
All right.
I don't know. I have no idea.
Lock it in. All right.
I wrote couch potatoes.
I've never heard of that show.
Supermarket sweep.
I wrote Double Dare.
I originally wrote Double Dare.
Yeah.
But you said not for kids.
It is Supermarket Sweep.
Yeah.
What?
Really?
Whoa. Yes. What is this show?
Huh. You don't.
You don't
know,
know what Supermarket Sweep.
I don't know.
It's so great. I'm ignorant.
It is a game show surrounding supermarket culture.
Oh.
Like, it's so set in a supermarket.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Fake supermarket. And then there's like trivia rounds where you're trying to match like the jingle to the brand.
Or you do little word puzzles.
You know what?
And then the last part is the best part.
Yeah. You get a shopping cart and you have like a ton.
And you try the most expensive stuff in your.
You know
cart.
What? I've seen parodies of this show, maybe with like on SNL with like Melissa McCarthy or somebody without realizing. Yeah. Okay,
they did
all
a
right.
parody of it.
Okay,
the show is very addictive.
I'll have to check it out.
And it's a fake supermarket with fake meat and fake cheeses. It looks real, but
yeah. What do you have to do? You just have to like. You have to at the end. You have to. There's certain items that are scattered throughout the supermarket that are worth more money.
Yeah, yeah.
But you have to get above a certain amount of money, right?
So you pick the expensive
ribeye
things.
Steaks and
big
meals,
cheese, diapers.
Yeah. You have to grind the coffee to get
and each contestants like there's three teams and they all have uniforms basically.
I'm gonna have to check it out.
Watch it and then you're like. What I would do. What my strategy.
I love supermarkets. I will have to check this out.
Yes. You know what, Dana? You're absolutely right. That show absolutely nailed the feeling of they're doing it wrong. And this is what I would do.
Yep. If you were to be on a game show, which game show would you want to be?
Oh, man.
If you pick Jeopardy.
Me now? Oh, Jeopardy.
Really?
Yeah.
Jeopardy freaks me out.
Double Dare. Because trivia is so easy on that show.
Yeah.
We would always be like, oh, you should double dare us. I don't know. And then, like, the answer.
And then, you make it
to the last. Yep. And then you have, like, a whole strategy for the obstacle course.
Do you think you could get your family on Family Double Dare, Dana? You think your mom and dad would be down for that?
We shouldn't do that.
We would lose.
The obstacle course.
I would choose...
Supermarket Sweep would be real fun.
Carmen Sandiego, but as an adult, I can't play it because I'm not a kid.
Right, yeah.
Crystal Maze, which is a UK show. It's kind of like Legends of the Hidden Temple.
Oh.
That'd be cool.
Crystal Maze. So UK listeners, I remember that show. I used to watch it.
Yeah.
Anyways, well, that's my Let's Make a Deal game show quiz.
I wish I was fit enough to be on America Ninja Warrior.
Oh, I love it.
It's so fun to watch. Yeah.
So when we settled on the topic of let's make a deal,
you
yes,
told
when
us.
I proposed it internally, I was thinking it's not can I find a funny sports contract weird trivia nugget to share? It was, which funny, crazy sports contract nugget should I share? Sure. Okay. Because, I mean, sports negotiations,
oh, yeah.
It's so much money is at stake, you know, millions and millions of dollars, and all these really weird kind of Byzantine rules about salary caps and just how much you can pay a player, and, you know, they're locked in, and you get into these crazy negotiations with agents. So I have a story for you guys about some interesting, funny, controversial, crazy sports contracts. But this is all related to one player and one team, the Mets. Okay. So this segment is called Mets Make a Deal.
No!
And I apologize. I apologize.
Nice.
Yeah, okay. All right, all right. So one of the great things about sharing sports stuff with you guys is that I can be like 99% sure that unless we're talking about a household name, you have no idea who I'm talking about, which is great. It's great. Yeah. You guys are the tabula rasa of sports stories. Right, right, right. Yeah. Unless it's Michael Jordan or like Tiger Woods or, right, yeah. So I'm guessing and hoping that you guys may not be familiar with the baseball player Bobby Bonilla.
I've heard his name.
Okay, all right. Well, that's I'll take that. Bobby Bonilla. Yeah, he's famous. He's sure. well known. Bobby Bonilla is associated with not one, but two of the most controversial deals the Mets have ever made, one of which has actually reverberated even beyond the world of sports.
Oh.
Yeah, how's that? All right. So this year, the New York Mets paid Bobby Bonilla $1.2 million. Now, that's, I mean, that's, you know, I mean, to us, that's a lot of money. But, you know, for a star baseball player, that's a fairly modest number, yeah, okay. $1.2 million a year. But
that's just getting by.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's just, you know, walking around money. Mm-hmm. But at one point in his career, Bobby Bonilla was actually the highest paid player in all of Major League Baseball.
Wow.
Wow.
This was with the Mets on his first go-round with the Mets. Now, so he was paid $1.2 million this year. He's had some great deals in the past. Now, before we go any further, though, there's one other detail you should know. Although he shows up on their payroll.
He's a dog.
There's no rule that says a dog can't play baseball. Bobby Bonilla is not a dog. Bobby Bonilla is a normal human man, a New York native. But even though he's on their payroll, he won't actually be on the Mets roster this year.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Bobby Bonilla has not played a game for the New York Mets since 1999.
Whoa.
Okay.
What?
He's a fake person.
We're talking about a pretty good deal here. This guy's getting paid $1.2 million and is not even having to lace him up here. All right. Let's back up a little bit here. I want you guys to readjust your minds to the 1990s.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Easy.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So Bobby Bonilla had been in the league for a few years already by the time we get to the early 1990s. And, you know, he had kind of a rough start. He overcame a lot of obstacles as a rookie. But he was definitely a star on the rise. He was a solid hitter, a smart hitter, most importantly, putting up really good numbers. And that's always a great thing to do right before you're a free agent. Because when your contract is expiring, you want to be playing really well because then it's like, all right, league, you know, I'm open to all offers. Yeah. Exactly.
But then are you playing poorly when you don't care, like when you don't have a contract coming up?
I'm not going to name any names, but across all sports, there are definitely lots of examples of players who get a little fat and satisfied. Yeah, I mean, if you sign, you know, a 5-year, multi-million-dollar contract, you know, to a cynical person, it's like you show up that next year, you're like, all right, well, I've got my money. I can kind of relax a little bit.
You always have to be, all right.
Until the last year, your contract is up.
Yeah, yeah. So Bobby Bonilla had a lot of interest before the 1992 season and ultimately ended up signing a 5-year, $29 million contract with the New York Mets. Now, and as I say, that made him the highest paid player in all of baseball. All right. So, you know, $6 million a year, give or take. The salaries have since, of course, gone even higher in the time between. But that was not only objectively a lot of money now, but relative to other players, that was a lot of money, you know, and everyone's kind of looking at the Mets like, whoa, okay, you're giving him how much? All right, he's good, but how much? Unfortunately, the New York Mets that year were, Not good.
Yeah.
Not good. They were not good. They went 72-90 that year. And losing in New York City as a way of exacerbating situations. As you guys can probably imagine, you are constantly under the spotlight in New York. And, you know, for all sports teams, if you sign the highest paid player in your sport, there's a lot of expectations. It's like, okay, well, let's see it. What are we getting for all this money that we're, you know, fans like to say we. You know, we see how much we're paying him this year, you know, as if the fans are contributing. I mean, in a way, they are. They're buying tickets to the games. The Mets did not have a good season that year, and the criticism – a big chunk of the criticism fell on his head. It's like, hey man, what are we paying you for? And he was having a good year. You know, he was,
his,
you know,
performance was good.
People can now, in retrospect, I'm certainly not a baseball guy, but people who know more about baseball than I do can look back now and say, yeah, you know what? For the money they paid him, it was a lot of money, but he, you know, they sucked, but it wasn't his fault. But, you know, big money has a way of drawing attention. So he was getting a lot of criticism. The team was getting a lot of criticism. And ultimately, unfortunately, they just decided, you know what? We need to part ways. You know, if we're paying you this much money and we're not winning, you know, what do we have to show for it?
Wait, can you do that?
Sure, you can trade players away. You know, you have all kinds of ways of parting ways with players.
But you have a con.
Sure, you have a contract, right? So you can trade somebody, and then the new team then takes on the terms of that player's contract.
Oh, okay.
Right, sure. You know, there are some other scenarios we'll get to in just a second, actually. I'm glad you're leading me here ahead. And, you know, they were still getting flack for this huge contract from their fans, from sports writers, you know, from other teams. Because other teams are like, thanks a lot, Mets. You know, now that you've anchored the price of a star player at 29, you know, million, other players are coming to me and say, well, if he's getting 29 million.
And they're not even winning.
That's right. Exactly.
Oh.
So, you know, in some way, a rising tide lifts all boats in professional sports. So Bobby Bonilla bounced around for the next few years, and he had some good seasons after he left the Mets, actually. I mean, he won a World Series in the process, I should say. He was on the 1997 Marlins team that won the World Series. And wouldn't you know it, got traded, moved around. He ends up back with the New York Mets. Back with baseball's New York Metropolitans. Aww. Yes, the Mets. Well, what could go wrong this time, right? Sadly, a lot could go wrong this time. Once again, the team was in a period where they were underperforming.
Man.
And Bonilla, again, faced a lot of criticism. And, you know, honestly, this time, a lot of it was fair. His numbers were just not as good as they had been. He was getting older. His production was declining.
Okay.
He was fighting with the manager. There was a famous incident in the 1999 playoffs where, while the Mets were out on the field being eliminated from the league championship series, so this is where you play to go to the World Series, all right? They were out on the field losing. Bobby Bonilla was in the clubhouse playing cards with Ricky Henderson, another controversial player.
It was Ricky Henderson.
He wasn't playing in that game.
Yeah, that's right. So, but that's not a good look to be in the clubhouse playing cards while your teammates are, you know, busting their butts on the field losing. They're getting toward the end of the 99 season, and the Mets are like, we got to part ways. We're paying you too much money. It's not working out. The Mets owed him $5.9 million for the upcoming season. That's right. So they flatly did not want to pay him this money. They were very upfront. You know, he and his agent knew. So what are their options? You can trade him. All right, but that means you got to find someone who's willing to take on that salary. And at this point of his career, that was not looking too likely. You can just release him and eat the money. I mean, you can just say, all right, you're done. Here's a check. Go away. And now we have a spot in our roster.
But did they have that money?
But exactly. But that's expensive.
Yeah.
And you kind of cringe at that. Ultimately, in this situation, what they ended up doing was negotiating a very creative deal with Bobby Bonilla and his agent.
Okay.
That people are still talking about to this very day. That people are going to be talking about until 2035.
Oh, my God.
Bobby Bonilla and his agent went to the Mets and they said, all right, you owe us $5.9 million. We will take a decade-long deferral on this money. You don't need to pay us a dime.
Okay.
We'll, with some interest, but beginning in 2011, you will pay Bobby Bonilla $1.2 million every year until 2035. So essentially, they set up like an annuity kind of style payment for him.
Yeah.
totally new for baseball. Like, this is just such a crazy situation, all right? When all the payments were said and done, Bobby Bonilla stands to make $29.8 million.
Because of interest.
Over the extended period and interest, right, over what would have been a seed payment originally of $5.9 million. All right. So the Mets, they wanted a roster spot. They're like, we have our eye on someone we want to bring in, so we need a roster spot. And we want to have money to pay this guy to bring in. So this is great for us. It saves a little bit of money. We can pay this new guy. Bobby Bonilla, if you're willing to wait, you know, God bless you. You'll set yourself up for life. You'll be fine. But this is kind of crazy. This is a lot of money to be deferred, right? And like over a long time period. I mean, sometimes you'll defer for a year or two, right?
Okay.
So why would a team do this? Why would a team defer this much money over this long a period? Over a decade, and then pay out $29.8 million instead of $5.9 million. So, you know, people around baseball kind of just shook their heads. They're like, there go those Mets again, just doing crazy Mets deals, you know, just penny-wise, pound-foolish maybe.
Right, because it sounds like robbing future you to pay current you.
It
you
does. Know?
It's like, well, I don't want to pay $6 million, but I'll make me from 30 years from now end up paying $29 million over that course of time.
It doesn't
make any sense. Are you going to tell us why it actually makes sense?
Chris, as it turns out...
End of episode.
Yeah. As it turns out, the owners of the New York Mets were among the most prominent investors with Bernie Madoff, the legendary New York financial fraudster who ran a massive, massive Ponzi scheme for decades, who had huge millionaire-billionaire clients, all right? So the Ponzi scheme, again, very quickly, is basically you're taking money from new investors to pay the old investors, and you're lying to them and telling them, like, oh, I've got these great investments working for you, getting huge rates of return. The Mets had as many as 500 accounts with Bernie Madoff, and for years, they were getting returns of 12 to 18% on their money, okay?
That's a lot.
That's a huge rate of return.
Yeah. Right.
And it was essentially guaranteed. So the New York Mets had this side revenue stream whereby they figured, okay, well, we can invest this $6 million with Bernie Madoff, and by the time we have to pay Bobby Bonilla, we're going to have made $70 million on this money. And they had it all worked out. And it turns out they've been doing this for years, of course, which is why you back up a little bit. One reason they were so willing to spend so much money in the 90s. They had approximately $500 million invested with Bernie Madoff.
Oh, my God.
Like when he was busted and it all went belly up.
Yeah.
You almost don't want to really call them victims because they were making a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, they were the old investors getting paid off with new victims' money.
Right.
Don't worry about Bobby Bonilla. His money is safe. His money is covered.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yes. Yeah. In the aftermath of the Bernie Madoff fallout, the Mets actually had to borrow money from Major League Baseball itself just to make payments. That's how bad it was when things finally hit the fan there at the end. And so Bobby Bonilla, again, so he is now, what are we? He's got his, we're now in the sixth year of his 25 years of payments. Right. I love the idea that in 2035, all right, he's going to be in his
70s. Yeah, I was just going to say, how old is he going
like,
to be?
Like, there are going to be people on
the... Now, does he have to show up?
He doesn't have to do anything.
Oh, okay.
It's just he does name.
So he actually played for a couple of years after the Mets, and he agreed to this deal. He was at the end of his career. His last couple of years were not terribly productive. He finally retired, you know, 2 years after that, and was just sitting and waiting. He's doing fine just now. He actually, in a deliciously poetic coda to the story, he actually now works for Major League Baseball, advising young players on how to be financially savvy.
Oh,
because he won the lottery.
Great work, Bobby Bonilla's
Bobby
agent.
Bonilla and his agent. Let's make a deal.
Wonderful.
Do not worry for him. Yeah, collecting that $1 million.
Do not cry for Bobby Bonilla.
Every July, he gets a nice check from the New York Mets organization. So, yeah, next time you take a new job somewhere, ask for the Bobby Bonilla deal, which is where you get to retire. And 35 years later, you're still getting $1 million a year.
okay, I have a little deal grab bag for you guys. Grab bag quiz, that All right. is. Let's do write down.
All right.
Let's do write down. All right. To get the U.S. history, the dreaded U.S. history question out of the way, I'll make that one first. What is the name for the series of programs instituted in the U.S. to help the country recover from the Great Depression?
Oh. Is this too obvious?
No, probably not.
I hope not, because I'm writing the obvious
Everyone
answer.
Everyone wrote.
New Deal.
The New Deal.
The New Deal.
The New Deal. Yeah, the New Deal was a Roosevelt joint. Mm-hmm. Was the term New Deal coined before or after Roosevelt took office?
Oh.
What is that like?
So did Roosevelt propose the New Deal like as a kind of a solution for fixing it before he was in office or after he was in office?
Oh.
Yeah.
You can do that after you're not president anymore?
Oh, like no, before he took office.
You mean like after you got elected. Campaigning, right?
That's what I mean.
Campaign slogan or was it a...
Exactly. Mm. Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
I said before, I think it was a campaign.
It feels like it.
I put campaign.
He said it during the convention when he accepted the presidential nomination.
That's a good bomb to drop.
Yeah.
He didn't, he didn't know that was going to be the line. He didn't know that people were going to hook into
New Deal. He wasn't planning it to be like people latch onto it.
No. Neither he nor the speechwriter thought it was going to be
the line was just like, I feel like we need a new deal, right? Yeah, or something.
The American people need a new deal. And then they're like... Yes, we need a new deal. Yeah. What's the name of the protagonist from the classic German folktale who sold his soul to the demon Mephistopheles? And his name is the adjective for these types of deals, actually.
I know you know it. It's in your punch bowl, Karen, for sure.
What? Read the question again. What is the name
of the protagonist from a classic German folktale who sold his soul to the demon Mephistopheles? And so his name is the adjective for deal with the devil tropes. Yeah.
I wrote Butt.
But it's Faust.
I wrote Faust.
Faustian bargain.
Faustian bargain.
Yeah. What Stephen King book that was turned into a film in 1993? It was about a demon who spent centuries traveling around the world, tricking people into selling their soul for things.
Stephen King novel made into a movie.
Yeah.
93.
That's...
Oh, that is late.
Yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'm right, but... I wrote the Tommyknockers.
I put Me, Joe Black.
Chris has it.
Al Pacino?
This is the Stephen King hole that I would fall into.
Yeah.
I'd see the demon, he'd be like, here's the rarest Nintendo game. And be like...
I knew you were going to get it, Chris.
You're like, yes. Yeah. Sold.
There's a really good Rick and Morty episode based on Needful Things. Anyway. All right. So this one is just a word, kind of a word question. A cheesemonger sells cheese. A fishmonger sells fish. What does a costermonger sell?
Oh.
Coster.
Spell it. C-O-S.
C-O-S-T-E-R-M-O-N-G-E-R.
Fishmonger. Was the other example?
Cheesemonger.
Cheesemonger.
There's also ironmonger. Mm-hmm. But what's coster?
Costerphobia. I put coal.
I put custard.
I put clothing, like maybe costume.
Yeah, these are all things that crossed my mind when I saw that word. It's actually... fruit and vegetables.
Huh.
Custer is a type of apple. It was a type of apple.
Wow. Costermonger. Yeah. That's a good one to know.
You just know it or you don't.
Yeah.
Which fitness guru popularized the deal-a-meal diet?
Oh.
Deal-a-meal.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's where you had cards and they had like different serving sizes or different kinds of foods you can eat and you would spend your cards throughout the day.
Yep.
I'm waiting for Colin to lock in. I think I have this.
Okay.
Oh, I know I have this.
What do you got?
Oh, I wish I wrote what Chris wrote.
I put Richard Simmons.
I wrote Jack LaLanne, but I wish I had written Richard Simmons.
It's the Richard Simmons. Yeah. Oh, God. As shown on every infomercial.
Yeah.
What five-word marketing phrase was first used by economists Joseph Calderon and John Van Leeuwen while running their highly profitable business, Paco's Tacos, in central New Jersey. It's a five-word marketing phrase.
Five-word marketing phrase.
Five-word. It's not no shirt, no shoes, no service. That's six words.
That's a good one. It's not really marketing.
Five-word marketing phrase.
Wow, Karen, wow, okay. Jeez. Marketing phrase.
Works for tacos.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yes, yeah. That's right. Okay. That's I agree. The buck stops.
You want crunchy or soft?
Famous marketing.
That's...
Buy one, get one.
Free. Dang it.
BOGO.
Yeah. Buy one, get one free.
Bogoff.
Bogoff.
You will.
Mm. Paco's Tacos.
All right.
Yeah. So what two-word phrase describes entering a binding agreement by intertwining the fifth phalanges with another person?
There's a couple possible answers for this.
I think there's only one answer.
Pinky swear.
Pinky swear.
Pinky swear.
Pinky swear.
Yeah.
You can say pinky promise also.
Oh, really? I've never heard that.
That's the alt. Yes. Pinky promise. Pinky promise.
That must be a Connecticut saying.
No. We always say pinky swear.
Unbreakable vow.
Unbreakable vow. Let's bring your wands.
Your souls intertwined.
Right.
Good job, you guys.
All right.
So I could only think of one way to end this, which is to talk about the thing we all want to happen when we go when we get up early on that Sunday morning and head out to that flea market. You know, we go to the garage sale. You want to find the big score, and so here are some of the biggest garage sale flea market scores in history.
Nice.
One of these we actually talked about on the show before.
Faberge egg.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. There was a scrap metal dealer went to a flea market, found an objet d'art, which was a golden egg, and he's like, oh, this is gold and jewels. I'll buy this and I'll scrap it. And then he realized it wasn't really worth the scrap value. Like, he paid a couple $1,000, but it was too much. So it just sat in his kitchen. And then one day he realized that it was, in fact, a Faberge egg. It was one of the birthday eggs made for the Russian czars, and he just happened to have it, and it sold for a couple $1 million. It was just ridiculous.
Bobby Bonilla money.
This sometimes happens in other situations too. 1989, a guy went to a Pennsylvania flea market, bought a picture, didn't like the picture, but he liked the frame. Starts to get to kind of taking the picture out of the frame falls apart. So now he's got nothing. He's got a crappy frame that fell apart. Like, yeah. He's got a painting he doesn't like. But between the picture and the frame was a folded up piece of paper. This folded up piece of paper was called a Dunlap broadside. The Dunlap broadside was one of the first 500 copies that were ever made of the Declaration of Independence.
You're kidding me!
I remember reading about Declaration of Independence.
Yep.
Who hid it there?
The previous owner. Like, it was just must have been in a family for a really long time, and they put it in the picture frame. Yeah, it sold for, in 1991 dollars, it sold for $2.5 million.
Whoa!
Nice.
Or two Bonillas.
Two Bonilla years.
The new unit. Yeah. That's in 1991, by the way. In 2000, it was sold again to TV producer Norman Lear, the creator of All in the Family. Bought it for $8 million. Took it on a nationwide tour where you could go see it.
Good for him.
He still owns it. Yeah, he That's did a cool. good job with it. Something that costs a little bit less money but is a very historically important thing. 2004, a guy in Chelsea, New York, looking through records at a yard sale. He finds a record with a handwritten label that read, Velvet Underground 425-66. It's like, oh yeah, the Velvet Underground. I should, pick this up. Yeah, turns out to be an acetate, so a temporary record that would have been, put down for like just temporary like purposes in the recording studio.
Yeah.
It's something you could just make it in the recording studio, just to have, but it wasn't a professionally pressed record. But it was early demos from the album The Velvet Underground and Nico, which is the one with the album with the Andy Warhol banana on the cover. You could peel the banana.
Peel and see.
But it was never before heard early versions of these songs. And it sold for $26,000.
Okay.
That's cool.
And let's see. 2007, family in New York buys a little bowl at a garage sale for $3. They like the design, just a handmade-looking bowl, put it on their mantle. Years later, they're like, eh, you should figure out what this is. They ask around, they ask some dealers. It turns out the bowl is from the Northern Song Dynasty in China. Oh. That's 11th century. And it sold for $2.2 million. Literally, there was like only one other bowl that was
they
sort of like that.
They paid $3 for it?
Yeah, oh, yeah, man. Garage sale. Yeah.
See,
because they like the bowl.
It does, you know, what always amazes me is the provenance of these items is,
yeah.
You know, I mean, like, not only has it survived this long without right. getting just smashed to a million pieces, but at some
passed
point,
down, yeah.
somebody knew its value at
yeah,
some
it
point. Yeah.
It
and
forgot.
It just yeah. lost
you know,
to the mist of time.
You
maybe.
Know, well, the thing is, you can't take it with you. And it's something that I yeah. try to remember as a collector yeah. as well. Like, you know, eventually I should do something with this stuff because what happens is, like, if you keep all of this stuff,
yeah.
you die,
yeah.
and, like, your family
they
doesn't
no
know,
idea.
Doesn't
yeah,
care.
It's true.
You've passed on this big burden to your surviving relatives, and
yeah.
they go in, they're just like, oh, my God, we have to sell all this stuff from Grandma's house, and stuff is going to slip through the cracks. You know, you got to
yeah.
do you gotta do something with it when you're alive.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
What are you going to do?
If I have things, because I do have some things that are like one of a kind and important, and those will go to a museum, basically.
Oh, okay.
So somewhere
you're a video game Indiana Jones. It's like this belongs in a museum.
No, I'm more the video game Marcus Brody. Actually,
nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Wow, that's a second level Indiana Jones reference.
Who plays him?
So
Denim Elliott. Denim Elliott. Yes, the wonderfully confused.
And so a word of warning to close. A lot of times you will hear stories about amazing flea market finds and things like that. And sometimes people are using that as a cover story. There was a
what do you
story.
Mean?
So there was a story that I saw, and I did a little bit more digging about a woman who said she bought a Renoir for $3 at a flea market. But then when they started digging into it, it's like this. It had been stolen from a museum in, like, the 1960s.
Yeah.
And then people kind of said, like, oh, we remember, like, her mother having this. I'm not saying her mom stole it or anything. I'm just
right.
saying that, like, she might have been making up a cover story
it's
as
so,
far
like,
as...
like, laundering it, basically.
She, yeah.
yeah.
So do your digging. But the ones that I told you about are definitely happened.
All right. And that's our show. It's funny because every time we do a show, I want to do like what we talked about. I'm like, oh, I'm all jazzed looking for good scores yeah. and try out negotiating tactics and go on a game show. Just like how last episode we talked about bagels and Burger King in Mattoon, Illinois. I was like, I just want a big bagel.
Yep.
Thank you guys for joining me. Thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned a lot of stuff about negotiation tactics. Bobby, what's his face?
I hope you learned a lot about Bobby, what's his face.
You seem to have heard
Bonilla,
not
Bobby,
even the,
Bonilla.
Not even the first thing about Bobby, what's his face.
It just like goes into a little void.
Bonilla, Bobby Bonilla for the Mets. Game shows and more. You can find it.
Bobby, the dog that played baseball. I think we all remember that story.
They pay him in milk bones.
Okay. $1 million a year.
That's right. Bernie Madoff had
yeah,
a hookup
yeah,
to the milk
yeah.
bones.
You got it. You got it.
It was a Pucci scheme.
Iron Vault.
Yeah.
Iron Vault.
Pucci,
yeah.
Pucci scheme.
Yeah.
Anyways, you can find our show on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Spotify, on SoundCloud, and on our website, goodjobbrain.com. So we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.